From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So, you're sitting in a traffic jam, pulling your hair out and running very late, when you see the person behind you in that expensive sports car zip past in the breakdown lane. You think he's gotten away with it until a police siren blares and he gets pulled over. Just deserts, you think. I hope he gets a big fat ticket, maybe jail time, maybe a public flogging. We've all felt it more than we're likely to admit. The Germans give that feeling a name. Schadenfreude is the dark human delight in other people's misfortunes. It's the feeling you get when the teacher's pet gets a B on a big test or the CEO you've envied takes a long, hard fall. This summer, with big timers like Martha Stewart, Kenneth Lay, and Jeffrey Skilling facing ruin after riches, Schadenfreude has become the season's favorite guilty pleasure. We're talking tonight about the thrill in someone else's woe, about Schadenfreude. Have you been overindulging this summer, cackling as masters of the universe go down in flames, maybe even as your once-rich neighbor or in-law or brother loses an enviable bundle in the stock market? What does this emotion tell us about human nature? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Aaron Ben-Zev, professor of philosophy at the University of Haifa and author of The Subtlety of Emotions. Good evening and welcome, Aaron Ben-Zev.
Good evening.
Very good to have you with us from far-off Israel. You have spent a lot of time thinking about Schadenfreude, exactly this, the human delight in the misfortunes of others. What is the origin of this this guilty pleasure?
This emotion is very natural. Like other emotion, it is based on the comparative nature. When we see people who are above us, we envy them. When we see people who are below us, we just please about this. It is just the comparative nature of this emotion, which is very natural to all of us.
But there's been a long debate about whether or not this was an ignoble emotion, whether this should be right up there with the seven deadly sins, with envy and greed, sloth, wrath, lust, gluttony, pride. Is Schadenfreude a sinful thing to think of taking pleasure when someone else has a rough patch, has a bad time?
Yeah, I don't think that it is a virtue, Schadenfreude, but it is not a sin. Let me say to you that in Schadenfreude we have two indisputable characteristics. One of them that the subject is pleased. The other is that the other person has misfortune. This is indisputable, but I would like to suggest three other characteristics which are essential to this emotion. The first characteristic is a misfortune is minor. The second characteristic...
A small, minor misfortune.
Yeah, smaller misfortune. The second characteristic that the other person deserves this misfortune. Mm-hmm. And the third one, that we are passive in bringing about this emotion.
In other words, that we actually help the person fall low somehow, that we push them off the cliff.
We didn't push them. Someone else did it. Someone else did it for us. It is like the saying that the task of the righteous get done by others, not by us. It is a kind of unsolicited gift. And like the example of the driver, in this example, the misfortune is a small since he just get a ticket. He's not killed, he's not get hurt, he just got a ticket, and they will pay money for this. He certainly deserve it, because he did harm. He harmed us and other drivers. And we didn't do it. It is a police person who did it. So these three characteristics are in the example of the driver who drive on the shoulders of the road and they get the ticket. You know, by the way, what non-religious, secular drivers will say when they will see it?
Well, they'll swear plenty when the guy goes by, and they'll be delighted when he gets pulled over.
Yeah, when it gets pulled over, they will say, there is God in heaven.
Even if they don't believe. Aaron Ben-Zev, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Good evening and welcome, Jack.
Good evening.
Jack, we're talking about Schadenfreude tonight, and it has been a sentiment that's got a big workout this summer in America, as we see all these executives with their multi-million-dollar pay packages brought low, as we see people who did beautifully in the stock market in the boom come down in the bust. We read about it in the New York Times. We read about it all over the place right now. The sense that we are taking a pleasure in the misfortune of others. There's some justice here, but there's something else at work as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Ronald Niebuhr once said that the only empirically verifiable fact about the Christian religion was original sin. you think of that when you recognize a Schadenfreude in yourself, you know, that there's just a sadistic and a cruel element in it that makes, I think, us all ashamed. On the other hand, I think there is in the feeling about public people being brought down, I think that associates us with the old notion of justice, that there's a certain pleasure in revenge, in seeing wrongdoers brought down. And that pleasure, although it has this alloy of cruelty in it, also I think has an alloy of sort of affirmation, you know, where there's a kind of civic pleasure in seeing a Bernie Ebers call to it. That's as it should be. He deserves it. I'm glad. It's like seeing justice done in some sense, and I don't think that's entirely to be ashamed of.
But the line between the two, between a kind of a dark joy in their misfortune and civic justice being done, is a very narrow one. Aaron Benzev quotes Oscar Wilde in a wonderful paper he's written on this, and he quotes Wilde saying, and this would apply to this summer, on an occasion of this kind, it becomes more than a moral duty to speak one's mind. It becomes a pleasure. And clearly we can see, beyond any aspect of justice, people are relishing the misfortune of others. And I'm wondering, Aaron Benzev, if it's not just the mighty and powerful famous that people take some pleasure in the misfortune of, but even the neighbor, even the brother-in-law who was rich on Wall Street and now is not. It seems to me that even in these more humble circumstances, human nature is prepared to take pleasure when people around us take a fall.
Yeah, it concerns with the comparative concern, which is central to all emotions. If someone was above us, then his fall, even if a relative fall, not a significant one, will please us. Schadenfreude is like a game of poker or tennis. You don't play it with anyone who is inferior to you. You play it with someone who is comparative to you, and in this sense, it is unlike cruelty. In cruelty, we behave in a way which is unjust, and we make significant harm, and we are active in bringing this harm. So in this sense, Schadenfreude is not something so negative, because it's something that the other person deserves it.
Maybe they deserve it. Aaron Benzev, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation John Portman. He's professor of religion at the University of Virginia and author of When Bad Things Happen to Other People. Good evening and welcome, John Portman.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Thanks so much for being with us. John Portman, we've just been talking about when there's a sense of justice and deserved approval in another's misfortune, and when Schadenfreude tips over into a kind of unseemly glee, if we really dig down and admit it, even when a friend may have some misfortune that sets them a little bit behind us. Does it cover the whole waterfront, everything from cackling at Jeffrey Skilling's woes at the top of Enron to the woes of a neighbor?
Well, that's a difficult question. It's a fascinating question, and really only we can know. Human interaction is really a very complex thing, and we can't read other people's minds. So only we know what the object of our pleasure is. Sometimes, no doubt, we are wicked. Sometimes we are unjustly profiting from or celebrating the misfortune of another person. But oftentimes, I think Professor Benzev is entirely correct, we do so because we care about justice. We want to see good people rewarded for having worked hard and obeyed the rules of the system, and we want to see bad people who've stepped out of line punished and made to see that they can't pull one over on the rest of us, that they can't, in fact, take an unfair advantage of us and reap a benefit, an advantage that they haven't won.
John Portman, you've written about how people have always had very ambiguous feelings about this sentiment of schadenfreude, that have even sometimes taken pleasure in the fact, or you note many languages don't even have a word for it. German happens to, and I couldn't help thinking before the show, taking a certain schadenfreude even in that we English speakers can pose as too good to have thought of it, but those two brilliant Germans came up with it, and now they're saddled with it. You write that there was a time when English-speaking moralists didn't even want to see this word in the Oxford English Dictionary.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think in a sense we're still living with that legacy. It's interesting that we, at least in the English language, have taken on board so many German words. Think of summer, winter, apple, swimmer, angst. And it's odd that we haven't taken on board this word, which would be enormously useful to us. I think one of the reasons why we haven't taken it on board is because of this fear that once we start using the word, we'll start feeling the emotion. And here, again, I'm in complete agreement with Professor Benzev. I think we've been feeling it all along. We just haven't quite known what to think about it, how to classify it, and so forth. And this is very interesting. If you look in the history of Western thought, there's this long-standing idea that once you name a threatening mysterious force like the wind or a hurricane or a malicious spirit, once you give a name to something, you can control it, you can subdue it. So you'd think that we would welcome the opportunity to find a name for this pleasure. But in point of fact, as you say, there seems to be evidence that we've done just the opposite.
You quote a thinker saying he was afraid if it came into the English language, we would be infected with this this wicked sentiment.
Exactly. Isn't that intriguing? Yes, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, the first person ever to use the word schadenfreude in the English language was an English archbishop named R.C. Trench, and he used the word in the middle of the 19th century in a book that he entitled The Study of Words. And in brief, he says, isn't language a fascinating thing? We've got a little of this, a little of that. And he devotes some time to talking about weird words, threatening words. And he says, as a prime example, isn't it curious and isn't it scary that the Germans, of all people, have a word for taking pleasure in the misfortunes of other people? He says, the mere fact that they have a word for this must prove that their entire culture is contaminated, is corrupted. And then he says, we should do everything in our power to keep this word, schadenfreude, out of the English language. Well, what's peculiar is that precisely in the course of telling us we should keep the word out, he brings the word in.
And he's using it. Aaron Benzev, you seem to think that ultimately schadenfreude serves the interest of justice, because as I read you, you see people taking pleasure when those who have gained advantage perhaps illicitly fall, and that's a kind of evening of the scales.
Yes, and in this sense it is quite natural. Look, all our emotions express our concern for ourselves and other people. This kind of sensitivity to other people include both positive and negative attitude. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we are sensitive to the success of other people, and we are sensitive to the fall of other people. We have two alternatives, either to be indifferent to other people, in this case we shall not have emotion, or to be sensitive to them. And I believe that sensitivity, which is more human, is characteristic of our attitude toward other people. And this attitude includes also our joy in the minor, in the small misfortune of other people, because in the comparative scale, we are in the positive side. And it is natural to be happy about your own success.
And yet, Jack Beatty, I think many of us would not like to admit how close a relation, a friend, even a relative, we've felt schadenfreude toward.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, when you level with yourself about this, you just can't get on your moral high horse. You realize you have these unconscious feelings that are, not only they're antisocial, but they are anti everything that you value at the conscious level, and it should kind of take you down a peg or two when you start to opine about other people's morals, because you've got this thing inside you.
It should, and we're all in the game, especially this summer. Aaron Benzev, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I know how late it is there, and you have to go. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Aaron Benzev is professor of philosophy at the University of Haifa and author of The Subtlety of Emotions. We're talking about Schadenfreude. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Schadenfreude, that dark joy of pleasure in the misfortune of others. Maybe you felt it this summer. Have you felt it? Do you know the guilty pleasure of Schadenfreude, when the Enron bums suffer, when Martha Stewart stumbles, when a rich neighbor falls? Does your heart quietly celebrate? Whose comeuppance has given you a thrill lately? Is it repugnant to enjoy others' troubles, or is it just human nature? Is it maybe even justice? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by John Portman. He's professor of religion at the University of Virginia and author of When Bad Things Happen to Other People. Right now we're joined on the line by CeCe. Welcome, CeCe. You're on the air.
Hey, welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you.
I think that this Schadenfreude word, you were talking earlier about this point in which it turns from a certain sense of justice or lifting suppression when it's a positive sort of energy that we experience as humans. When it becomes negative, I believe, is when we embody and enjoy a certain degree of hate. I think hate is the fulcrum point, so to speak, on the pendulum where we actually sort of become our own enemy with this energy.
Do you see people picking up hate when they begin to luxuriate in Schadenfreude, in the misfortunes of others, CeCe?
Oh, absolutely. I was a cab driver during the Gulf War era, and I saw what happened when people stopped talking or were afraid to say anything because they were afraid they were going to sound anti-American at the time. And that fear that they embodied was really, really, really suppressed. But when we started winning the war and when the media started reporting it like it was a soccer game or a football game, how many bombs, how many died, yay, we cheered and stuff like that, that's a blind hate that we were throwing back at them, so to speak. This us-them scenario is dangerous.
CeCe, it's an interesting point. Let me put it to John Portman, and thank you for your call. John Portman, where does the glee that we feel at others' misfortunes rub up against hate, rub up against cruelty, rub up against things that we would describe as clearly not ideals?
I wish I knew. That's a terrific question, and that is a question that I've pondered many times. There is something very ugly about resolving to hold other people accountable for the wrongs that they do us. Think about a teacher who catches a well-meaning student cheating in school, and the student cries and begs, please, please don't turn me in. I promise I'll never do this again. And the teacher might say, look, this is really for your own good. I'm really sorry. I believe that you'll never do it again, but justice demands that I hold you accountable for this crime. Think about the courtroom dramas that play themselves out in the daily news. There's something really nasty about telling people, maybe spouses who have cheated on us, look, I'm sorry, I do forgive you, but I'm going to make you pay the consequences here because that's what justice is all about. Maybe that's the only way that you'll ever really learn your lesson. So hatred does come into the equation. You're absolutely right, and particularly in war. CeCe mentioned a war. I think many Americans were devastated to see the video clips the day after the 11th of September, video clips of Palestinians jumping for joy in the streets and celebrating our terrible tragedy. This sight brought home to us the lesson that, well, there are two sides to every question, and although we habitually think of ourselves as the good guys, there are other people out there who think of us as the bad guys, and people who are going to hold us accountable for what they consider injustice on our part, that's to say, unfairly taking advantage of the rest of the world, taking more of their resources and so forth. So, yes, I think CeCe's right. Hatred does enter the equation here, and I think it's impossible to say at what point Schadenfreude or any sort of virtuous celebration of seeing justice done drifts over into hatred.
Of course, passing big-time judgments from whatever vantage can always run the risk of that. And Schadenfreude often comes with this belief that others deserve their misfortune.
Yes.
Read that Thomas Aquinas claimed that one of the pleasures of the saints in heaven will be to observe the torments of the damned in hell.
Yes, that's wicked, isn't it? And it's shocking.
Saint Thomas Aquinas.
Christians. Yes, yes. Yes, you're right. At one point, Saint Thomas Aquinas, the cornerstone of Roman Catholic theology, is asked, what will heaven be like? Will the saints in heaven be allowed to see the damned in hell? And if so, what will the saints think about all this?
Mm.
And St. Thomas Aquinas quite provocatively answers, yes, the saints in heaven will be allowed to peer over the precipice of heaven and see into hell. And once in hell, of course, the damned will suffer unspeakable torture. I mean, much worse than anything that we could imagine tonight on the phone or worse, if you can believe it, than what we endured on the 11th of September. Hell is very awful. And yet, St. Thomas Aquinas responds, the saints will enjoy the spectacle. Now, he's very careful to dissect this pleasure into two parts. And I think a lot of people today are still doing the exact same thing. St. Thomas Aquinas says, well, look, the pleasure that the saints feel will be of two kinds. Firstly, and principally, the pleasure will be in seeing justice done.
Yeah.
Aha, God really does exist, and God really did mean it when he said, if you sin,
thou
you
shalt
will
not.
Suffer.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, he says, another source of the pleasure, the joy that the saints will feel, is in realizing how good they have it. So it's a kind of sort of relief from being exempt from the terrible suffering of the damned in hell. But I think that for many of us, there's often a kind of third joy as well, and that is in seeing bad people suffer. Christians are taught from Augustine on to separate the sinner from the sin. You know, love the sinner, mm-hmm. but hate the sin.
Mm-hmm.
But we think of people principally in terms of what they do. Martha Stewart is a human being who deserves sympathy, no doubt, but she's also a media mogul. She's a star. And we've heard through gossip, which is a principal channel of Schadenfreude, we've heard that off the camera she's actually kind of a nasty person. And so we have this tendency to think of the sinner in terms of his sins, think of a virtuous person in terms of their virtue. And so it's very, very complicated to separate out hatred from Schadenfreude, even love from Schadenfreude. But there's at least a conceptual possibility in there that when we take pleasure in the misfortunes of other people, we really are saying, this is all to the good because you deserve this. And you.
But of course, those other people may not be high and mighty. They may be a neighbor, a friend, even a relative who has nothing like Martha Stewart's celebrity status. That makes it look a little less noble, doesn't it?
It does. It does, yes. Dostoevsky, for example, says that we will always feel pleasure, even in the misfortunes of neighbors we love, even in the misfortunes of family members we care about deeply. And this is something that I think about as well. I have a couple of possible answers for this, but I've got to say that this is a pleasure much more difficult to justify.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have an evolutionary psychologist on the phone who can tell us all about why this happened.
We'll be talking with him in a moment, but I want to ask listeners, how close to home has Schadenfreude come in your life? Pleasure at the misfortune of a celebrity, a friend, a relative? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Martin is on the line. Hi, Martin. You're on the air.
Yeah, good evening.
Good evening.
Well, I grew up in Germany, and I want to bring Schadenfreude back to the basics a little bit. And
please.
To my very first experiences with it. And how I experienced this really as kids, you know, you run along and one of them, you know, falls into a puddle and gets all wet.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone laughs. So it's a lot more instinctual. And, you know, it goes automatically without really giving much thought to it.
This isn't a moral judgment. This isn't deeply considered. It's just a natural response when the other kid falls in the mud hole.
Right, exactly. That's what I believe what it is, you know. That's where I believe, you know, you can say, well, it's our instinct to respond that way, you know, without putting any thought to it.
Martin, do you think it's the same instinct, just grown up and dressed up, that we feel when we see Enron executives brought low?
I think when we look at Enron and examples like that, I think it's more of a thought process that you go through. You think about the situation, you know, you think about the guy speeding by on the breakdown lane and you think, oh, you know, I wish there would be a cop who, and he would get caught.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more thought process that happens and it's not quite the same spontaneous reaction.
Not straight from nature. Martin, thanks for your example and your call. I do want to bring into our conversation now John Tooby. He's co-director of the Center of Evolutionary Psychology at the University of California in Santa Barbara. Good evening and welcome, John Tooby.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Very well. Thanks for being with us. John Tooby, take us back into exactly your field, the evolutionary psychology of this particular sentiment, if sentiment's the right word, of Schadenfreude. Our caller Martin said just now he thinks it's a natural instinct. We see someone else fall in a mud hole, and it strikes us as funny. It gives us a thrill, a kind of joy. How deep in the human psyche is that, and why?
I think it's part of universal human nature. I think it's turning out that our psychological architectures, our minds, are much more complicated than might be appreciated. So there might be actually several different flavors of Schadenfreude.
So this is like 60 words for snow, or actually 60 different kinds of snow.
Well, that's more. Actually, it turns out that there's only three words for snow in Inuit,
it's one of the
big myths. But that's actually because you don't actually need all that many different words for snow. But with here, it might be that our minds are much more complicated than we have words for, than we have simple single words for.
Pick the thread apart for us a little bit, then.
Okay, let me give the pseudo Schadenfreude maybe first, what we would talk about, which is that, for example, I noticed I lived in Boston for 15 years. Mm-hmm. And then I moved out to California, and I turned on the TV set, and I see the news story, and it says, massive blizzard locks up entire East Coast.
And your friends in Boston are suffering.
And I feel this little burst of pleasure, okay? And I'm looking out, and there's flowers blooming in mid-January, and so I'm asking, where is that pleasure coming from? Which is, not so different than, different in degree, but not different than, I remember there was reports, I don't know if they're true or false, but reports that during World War II, sometimes soldiers felt pleasure when the person next to them was shot.
Ooh. Okay,
and you think, how sick is that? That's mm-hmm. really monstrous. They're comrades, they're close friends, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that this is not a case of genuine Schadenfreude. I think that the mind all the time has to make decisions about certain kinds of things, not certain that those decisions are correct or incorrect, and then it has to reinforce or undermine the criteria for making those decisions so that when you make a decision like moving out to California, I miss a lot of things about Boston,
mm-hmm.
Then I get this big signal. Boy, one thing I don't miss is losing, so many days, so many months in the wintertime.
And it justifies your decision to move.
It justifies the decision. And therefore, the suffering of the other people is not what you're taking pleasure in. It's the validation of your judgment.
At the evolutionary level,
you have your head down.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go out? Do you not go out? And then the person next to you is shot. That says you were right in keeping your head down, and that the person's anguish or suffering is not the object. And I think that's a thing that we all have that's frequently mistaken for Schadenfreude.
At the level of evolutionary psychology, I want to ask you, is it possible that this is humans looking at life as a zero-sum game? Someone else's misfortune at some very rudimentary level must be my gain, so I smile.
Yeah, I think that you put your finger on a key element, but I don't think we need to... That it turns out that a lot of the mechanisms in our minds, evolved mechanisms, are in fact very sophisticated mechanisms. They're not the mm-hmm. sort of old idea of an instinct is something crude and
primitive.
And it turns out they're very finely crafted. So genuine Schadenfreude, I think, exactly comes from what you're talking about, that we come that all these emotions are designed to operate in a world of 60 people or 100 people that you live with on a daily basis and you're interacting with all the time. And in such a world, there's very strong reasons to cooperate, and we have very strong pro-social emotions
mm-hmm.
And ways of thinking. But also, a certain dimension of that life is zero-sum, especially status is zero-sum. Somebody
status.
Else climbing in status puts you lower down in the status hierarchy in other people's minds.
Mm-hmm.
And so in particular, the thing that Schadenfreude addresses, I think, is the benefit that people derive when other people drop in status, and that intrinsically, if they're not a close family member, if they're not a really close friend, then that's really something that does represent benefits the individual. And like the mind is designed to welcome other kinds of benefits, just or unjust, good or evil. this is something that the mind just opens itself up to and welcomes.
Jack Beattie, at that level, it makes Schadenfreude look like the recognition of an opportunity.
Yeah.
He lost a job. Maybe I'll get it. Or his status in the neighborhood is down. Maybe mine in the neighborhood is up.
Yeah, it doesn't sound as if it's reveling so much in the suffering of the person as in the comparative advantage to you. But I'm just struck. I mean, I sort of take a psychoanalytic view of this, and it seems to me this the ground of this is ambivalence. That is to say that even in love, even in our most intimate, closest relationship, there is an element of hatred, of resentment, stemming right from the fact that we were so long dependent upon our parents as children, and that our parents, let us down or didn't do what we wanted. And early on, love got tinctured with this resentment and hatred. And it's that is the human condition, it seems to me, and that Schadenfreude comes right out of that. And, you know, when you look in the mirror and you see, gosh, I'm the person who feels this occasionally, it is a sobering moment. But I just think that as Americans, we do see things in Manichaean terms, good, bad, and so on. Ambivalence says, hey, they're all together, folks, in the stream of life.
John, Tubi, what about it? Are we always riding these kind of closely alternating currents of love, hate, generosity, greed, and Schadenfreude is when we slip from one to the other?
I think I certainly think that these things are going on all the time in all of us, and that I think also that part of, again, an evolutionary perspective relocates you down to the fact that sort of perhaps not quite as intensively the psychoanalytic viewpoint, but fairly closely to that these emotions are, you know, evolved in a crucible where they were originally for. Their original function had to do with people you were living with and interacting with every day, including that even in the closest relationships, there's elements of conflict. There's elements of changes in power about who gets to make an important decision and mm-hmm. so on. And so that there's this, and so you have at the same time very strong love for people, very strong welcoming of their welfare. At some point, I mean, the previous speaker talked about the minor nature of the misfortune. I think the minor nature of the misfortune is important in that's when we feel it with our close family members.
And of course,
that's what allows mm-hmm. us to, but that it can be of any magnitude, as somebody was talking about with the Palestinians celebrating 9/11 or you know, us celebrating some victory, you know, in another military context or whatever, that the extent that we aren't bound by ties of love or that limit the appetite we might have for the lowering of other people in some kind of competitive relationship, then people can feel this to any degree.
And through the media today, we can feel that kind of intimacy with figures who are actually thousands of miles away or far above us in social station.
That's right. And I think the mind isn't really designed to understand, since we never had television in the world we evolved in, we don't really understand that the world has millions of people in it. And so if you see Martha Stewart cooking, you know, after Nightline every night, the mind sort of accepts that. That's a person in your world. And therefore, even though in reality it has no effect on you, your mind can't appreciate that, you know, all these strangers really do have very little effect on you.
There she stands in our psyche. John Tubi, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome.
John Tubi is co-director of the Center for Evolutionary Psychology at the University of California in Santa Barbara. We're talking tonight about Schadenfreude, the dark joy of pleasure in the misfortune of others. Have you felt it? Do you know the guilty pleasure of Schadenfreude? When the Enron bombs suffer, when Martha Stewart stumbles, when a rich neighbor takes a fall, does your heart quietly celebrate? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Schadenfreude, the dark joy of pleasure in the misfortune of others. Whose comeuppance, whose trouble has given you a thrill? Confess your Schadenfreude. Are you ashamed of it? Do you rationalize it? Do you accept it? We're joined tonight by John Portman. He's professor of religion at the University of Virginia and author of When Bad Things Happen to Other People. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. Meredith is on the line. Welcome, Meredith. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm really glad that we're talking about this because I think a lot of people need to, I mean, of course, I'm ashamed of it. I feel sometimes like vengeful against people and things. But I lived in South America for about 5 years,
mm-hmm.
and I came back home about 3 years ago, and I feel nothing but animosity in the air, a lot of animosity.
In the American air, the North American air.
Yeah. I just, I love this country. It's not like I don't, you know, respect the flag. But I believe that if we start to understand how hateful and vengeful we feel, that we're going to be able to conquer and, you know, this problem, this hateful problem that we all have this problem, and everybody's not alone in this at all.
Meredith, stand by. I want to put it
better than others.
Stand by. I want to put this to John Portman. This is an interesting thing. Is it possible, John Portman, for different cultures at different times to have more of a hair trigger in the glee they take in the misfortune of others? Can it be a sign of social malaise?
Yes, I think it is possible, and I think it's happening now in part because of the economy, because of the downturn in the stock market. So many wealthy, powerful people are suffering now. But I think Meredith is on to something else, which is extremely important. We tend to admire people who take stands, people who have strong beliefs. These are people who lead nations and, you know, PTA meetings in the neighborhood school and so forth. And so we like people to pledge their allegiance to another person, a spouse, to a religion, to a country. And the natural consequence, unfortunately, of that happening is oftentimes Schadenfreude.
Why? How so?
Well, think about morality in our country. It's an ugly fact, I think, but it's been fairly well documented now that at the outbreak of the AIDS crisis, Americans were very, very slow to commit resources to research because they thought, well, this is basically the plague brought on a group of sinners, gay men, who for the most part suffered exclusively from the disease at the beginning.
So a kind of they deserve it Schadenfreude on a grand scale.
This is a grand scale, yes, exactly. And Meredith's point ties in very nicely with a point made by a German theologian, a guy named Bernard Haring, who actually just died 2 years ago. He was about 100 years old. Writing in the mid-1950s, this theologian, probably the most influential Roman Catholic moral theologian of the 20th century, says, writing in German again, it is a terrible sin to feel Schadenfreude unless, he says, the pleasure that you feel comes at the expense of one of the awful enemies of God. And you put it very nicely earlier, Jack. You said that this is the recognition of an opportunity. So what Bernard Haring would say, and this, of course, Bernard Haring was writing before the outbreak of AIDS. Bernard Haring would say, you know, gay men violate God's law, and it's all to the good that they should suffer. This is a way of our showing them that they have done something truly awful, and they're being punished.
Would have been Bering's view?
I'm sorry?
This would have been the theologian's view that you're quoting?
Oh, yes. He talks about the awful enemies of God, which is perilously ambiguous because, of course, for a long time, Jews were considered the awful enemy of God. And
they were on even stranger terrain because every generation, or at least century, has its own nation of enemies of God.
Absolutely.
Meredith, I will ask you, you said moving from America back to the United States, you felt more of this kind of vengeful tinge in the air. Are you sure that it was there, or is it perhaps that you come to your home country, you recognize it more here?
I think that, for example, in our country, we tend to ignore a lot of the older folks. We keep them in nursing homes. We keep them far away from us, the people that are young and free and having a good time and, you know, working hard, whatever, and have, you know, kids and children. And I on in South America, everybody's eye on one another, and I think that helps to keep the bond and love between one another, and their spirits seem to be, you know, they seem to be more trusting in each other, and I think that we've lost touch with that a lot. And, you know, I'm not a deeper religious person. I tend to be more on the Buddhist side. I believe that, you know, we have to start fighting for kindness. We have to start with our hearts. Sometimes it hurts to be able to give to other people, but I think we need to understand our hateful feelings.
And here's the anti-Schadenfreude vote, fighting for kindness. Meredith, thank you so much for your call. Steve's on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Great job, Tom. I think it's mostly rooted in revenge. And I think that what people get pleasure of isn't so much that other people are hurting, it's more so that these people or the generalization or a figurehead of these types of people have hurt you in the past.
So they deserve it, off with their heads and good riddance.
Well, because they've hurt you somehow in the past, like the Palestinians dancing in the street. They deem that we have hurt them, our way of life and society has hurt them. So I think it's more from a revengeful standpoint.
But let me ask you then, Steve, in your own case, have you ever felt schadenfreude toward a friend, toward someone who you should feel affection toward? Maybe you, even though you were competitive in some dimensions and they had some setback and you thought, oh, that raises my stature.
Well, yeah, not so much that it raises my stature, but I think I have felt that towards a friend in the past. But I do think it's from feelings that or conflicts that you've had with that friend in the past. So that friend has done something to you previously in your life, and that's why you feel a little good when something bad happens to even a friend.
Got it. Thanks for your call, Steve. John Portman, is it all about revenge, even when it's a friend or relative toward whom we feel schadenfreude?
Well, I don't know, Tom. I'll put the question back to you. I mean, do you know Martha Stewart? I certainly don't. I don't have any need to wreak revenge on Martha Stewart. I think
yeah,
that
but all- she stands for she's in the last few months she's come to stand for this kind of huge cloud of executive overreach of powerful people thinking that they can break the law of the high and mighty thinking that they're above the rest. And so, in that sense, I know her as an icon.
Right. Right. I think that that explanation is somewhat compelling, but I think that it's also the case that if we pay our taxes honestly, well, then, damn it, everybody else has to as well. And we buy into the system of justice. And once we do, we want to see it enforced. And it's a combination of resentment that Martha Stewart sort of deceived us because she came into our living rooms. She taught us how to make omelets and how to choose chintz for the window treatments and so forth. She told us that she was our friend, and she made us think that she was an upstanding American citizen. And then we found out that, well, perhaps she's not our friend, and perhaps she isn't following all the rules. So I think that on some level we think, hey, you know, we have to obey by all these rules. We're buying into the system. You have to as well. You're not above the law. So perhaps there's some room for revenge, but here as well, the explanation is somewhat complicated.
John Tooby, human emotions, wherever we touch them. I'm sorry, John Portman. These emotions are complicated wherever we put the fork in, but thanks for helping us untangle them tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tom, for having me along tonight.
Great to have you. John Portman is professor of religion at the University of Virginia and author of When Bad Things Happen to Other People. Jack Beatty, here's what Immanuel Kant has to say. He argues that in stormy weather, when comfortably seated in our warm, cozy parlor, we may enjoy speaking of those at sea, for it heightens our own feeling of comfort and happiness. Let them shiver.
He also said, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing can be made. And boy, is this the crookedest timber of them all.
Oh, well, at least we're all crooked timber together, Jack. Thanks for being with us this hour, Jack.
All right.
Listeners, all you schadenfreude enjoyers, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, speaking backwards and moving forward in France. This is On Point. Travel to France today with a solid comprehension of the language, and you still might not be able to understand the conversations in Paris. If your French friend greets you with Jour bon ça ave instead of Bonjour ça va, your hearing isn't off. He's speaking Verlan. At one time a slang language of the immigrant periphery, Verlan has saturated France's youth and pop culture, but Verlan has come to represent much more than just jumbled French or a cool new way to speak. We spoke with Natalie Lefkowitz, a professor of French Applied Linguistics at Central Washington University and author of Talking Backwards, Looking Forwards, The French Language Game, Verlan.
Verlan was originally a secret language game that was based on the inversion of syllables and was used by criminals and the military in order to conceal information from non-members of their group. And the word itself, Verlan, is a Verlanized form of the word l'envers, which in French means reverse or backwards. In the 70s, the second generation North Africans and other immigrants located on the outskirts of major French cities developed this project or street language in a way to symbolize their diverse linguistic and multicultural identities. And since they are between cultures, they needed to create a culture of their own. In the 80s, this became very appealing to mainstream French. The advertising, movies, media, rap music, and even dictionaries embraced this new code language, and then adult urban professionals started using it. It's called joie bourge, which is a Verlan form for bourgeois, as a kind of politically correct way of showing solidarity with this immigrant community, especially at times of, right now, anti-immigrant sentiments in France. It's a coolness marker and a rebelliousness marker. Verlan has represented a kind of covert prestige. Rather than what we're familiar with in France, what is known as overt prestige, where there's an appreciation for language purity and maintaining of standard speech and cultural norms, Verlan and the use of it has converted into a covert prestige, showing allegiance toward kind of non-standard, non-mainstream subcultures. And the speaking backwards becomes a kind of metaphor of opposition. So talking backwards is a way of talking back. And sounding bad by conventional standards, in fact, becomes good. So it's a way of reversing the French established norms. And the immigrants themselves who use this language do that so that they have a reversal of the negative connotations associated with them by the French. Once the Verlan gets too well known, like it has been embraced by the media, for example, a process known as re-Verlanization occurs, in which the Verlanized word gets re-Verlanized and then again shortened so that it becomes less visible to the non-initiated. A common example of re-Verlanized word is the word beurre, which originally comes from Arabe. It was originally used by the French with a negative connotation, talking about second-generation North African Arabs. It was embraced by them as their own term. And now, because it's so penetrated the standard French, they, among themselves, re-Verlanized beurre as rebe and shortened it to rub. This gives a connotation not only of being the group they are, but an additional feeling of being in between those cultures of that descent living in France. But the re-Verlanization is done to make it less transparent, to make it less comprehensible once it has spread too much into the non-initiated community.
Natalie Lefkowitz is a professor of French Applied Linguistics at Central Washington University and author of Talking Backwards, Looking Forwards, The French Language Game, Verlan. On Point is produced by Shimaline Dubow, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Chris Bonacci, Michael Garth, and Sabi Mayer. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is